This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The U.S. State Department has long accused Syria of harboring Palestinian terrorists, including the ones thought to be responsible for the bombing of Pan Am Flight 103. Syria's president, Hafez al-Assad, is a dictator who has been one of the Arab world's harshest critics of the U.S. and its support of Israel. Now the U.S. and Syria are working together to stop Saddam Hussein, a longtime rival of Hafez al-Assad. Less than 3 years ago, Iran and Iraq were engaged in a brutal war. Now it appears they're making amends. Their opposition to Israel and the United States may be taking precedence over whatever differences they had that led to 8 years of war and over 1 million casualties. The current war in the Middle East is creating some strange bedfellows, as countries who were once mortal enemies now find themselves on the same side. Fresh Air producer Amy Sallet spoke about these shifting alliances with Patrick Seal, a British writer who is the author of 2 books about Syria, including a recent biography of Hafez al-Assad.
Even though Syria and Iraq have had a long history of bad relations, they actually have a lot in common. Can you tell us what the two countries have in common politically?
Well, what they have in common is they're ruled by a party of the same name, but that's about as far as one can go, because that party split in 1966, and the two countries are ruled by rival wings of the same party. I would say there's one fundamental thing to bear in mind, which explains the differences between them. Iraq has, over the last decade, been fighting Iran, and it sees its enemy as Iran, or at least it did until this recent crisis, whereas Syria, of course, has been always looking over its shoulder at Israel and sees Israel as the main enemy. And so they couldn't really agree on who was the main enemy. That was really the fundamental difference. Of course, Iraq wanted Syria to join it in the war against Iran, and Syria wanted Iraq to join it in the war against Israel. So that was a fundamental difference, quite apart from sort of personal antagonism between the two and a lot of blood between them, a lot of attempts at sabotage, terrorism, and to unseat each other. In each capital, there's a sort of Trojan horse or shadow cabinet of the other. So there are many, many points of dispute. But nevertheless, it is a dispute between brothers.
Tell me more about the Ba'ath Party. Saddam and Assad both head up different factions of the Ba'ath Party, and they're both secularists, they're both Arab nationalists. Can you tell us more about the Ba'ath Party?
Yes, in a nutshell, this was a party founded in the late 40s in Syria by two schoolmasters, a Christian, and a Michel Aflak, and a Muslim, Salah al-Din Bitar. And it was essentially a party which appealed to students, to young people. And the main idea about it, putting in the simplest terms, was that the Arab world at that time was in a very powerless state. It had been occupied by the Turks for 400 years, then by the British and the French. It had failed to resist the onslaught of Zionism. The Israelis had been able to set up their state on Arab territory. And so generally, Arabs felt that their fortunes were at a very low ebb. And so this party, and its name in Arabic means rebirth or renaissance, it was an attempt to rally Arab forces and on a program of reform, revolution, rebirth. Now, it's mainly thought of as a pan-Arab party in the sense that they believed that salvation for the Arabs lay in frontier smashing, in forming a single big Arab power able to stand up both against the Jews on the one hand and, of course, the Western powers on the other.
When Assad and Saddam each speak of this Arab nation, could you describe the vision that each of them holds of this type of Arab nationalism?
Well, this, Amy, is a very contentious question because though many Arabs believe that there is something called an Arab order, that there is something called an Arab nation, and of course, the various Arab states have much in common, the language, religion, common history, common culture, and so forth. Nevertheless, the Arab world is divided into nation states, and these nation states have very different national interests and have very often been at odds with each other. So you can't say that there is such a thing as an Arab consensus. One thing has united them, and that was opposition to Israel and support for the Palestinians. But even there, it has to be qualified, because frequently national state interests were opposed to Palestinian interests. Individual states, anxious to protect themselves against Israeli retaliation, often acted as a brake on Palestinian activism. And so it's very hard to say that there was ever anything called an Arab consensus. And that's why, of course, the Arab League was toothless, as it was proved to be in this last crisis.
So do you think that Assad and Saddam each hope for this one united Arab-speaking world for the betterment of the Arabs, or is their main concern more that they be the leader of this type of Arab nation?
You see, this notion now of a single Arab nation has really gone out of fashion, and it's been out of fashion for a very long time. In fact, one can ask whether it was ever more than just a gleam in the eye of the Ba'ath Party founders. The man who is normally thought of as the great Arab leader of modern times was, of course, President Nasser of Egypt. Now, he didn't believe in this notion of one single Arab state. His idea of Arab unity was Arab solidarity. He wanted Arab states to pile in behind Egypt in its conflicts with the powers. And that, in a sense, I would say, is much more the idea which is still current in the Arab world today. But if one should add to that, that individual Arab states have competed for leadership in the region. And of course, I prefer to look at it as if the Middle East is an interlocking system of states. Now, at different times, different states have sought the leadership of this system. For example, Egypt under Nasser did try and dominate the whole system and force everybody to toe the Egyptian line. Then, for example, Israel tried to lead the whole system, to dominate it, it sought hegemony after the 67 war, and then particularly after the 82 invasion of Lebanon. Then we get Iran under the Ayatollah, again sought to dominate the whole system and had to be contained. Each one of these parties, Egypt was contained, then Israel was to some extent forced back out of Lebanon, then Iran was contained by the Gulf War. Now we have Iraq making its bid for leadership, and it in turn, so the other players say, has to be contained.
My guest is Patrick Seale. He's written a biography of the president of Syria called Assad, and he also has an earlier book called The Struggle for Syria. When the Shah of Iran was overthrown and Khomeini took over in Iran, and he established a revolutionary Islamic state. And at that time, Assad established an alliance with Iran. But there are many contradictions in that alliance, and he was criticized by other Arab countries for forming this alliance with Iran. And why? What are some of the problems there?
Well, you see, first of all, a fundamental principle of Arab nationalism, which President Nasser of Egypt had advanced, was that the Arabs should unite only among themselves. Arabs should unite only with Arabs. That's how President Nasser put it. And so it caused a bit of a shock in the Arab world when Syria, which considered itself a prime champion of Arab nationalism, allied itself with a non-Arab state, Iran, against its Arab neighbor, Iraq, in the Gulf War. Now, of course, President Assad of Syria prides himself on his foresight, and he believes that events have often proven him right. And in this case, I think with some justice, he felt he was right. And his argument was this. His argument was that the Iran of the Ayatollahs was a very different species, a very different creature from the Shah's Iran. The Shah's Iran was tied up with the United States, was Israel's ally, whereas the Shah of the Ayatollahs was a non-aligned country. It wanted to help the Arabs. It would have been a very useful ally for them in the struggle against Israel. And that's why one of the reasons why Assad allied himself with Iran. And he bitterly criticized Saddam Hussein at that time for what he considered the wrong war against Iran at the wrong time and against the wrong enemy.
So Iran was opposed to Israel, but Iran was also a revolutionary Islamic state. And didn't that threaten Assad's vision of a secularism that he was promoting in his country?
Well, it should also be remembered on the religious front that President Assad is a member of a small Shiite sect, or a sect derived from Shiism, which, as you know, is, of course, the sect dominating in Iran. And so one could argue that there was a sort of sectarian link between Tehran and Damascus, which extended even to the Shiite populations of Lebanon. So on that front, I think it's probably a mistake to say what a strange thing it is that a secular power like Syria should unite with a theocratic power like Iran. It's more a question, really, of state interests dictating the alliance. What the Syrians did was to bring Iran into the heartlands of Arab politics in a way it never had been before. Under the Shah, Iran was very much a marginal power, whereas perhaps thanks to Assad, Iran has really entered Arab politics, and we're seeing that today very much with Iran emerging as perhaps one of the arbiters of the post-war situation in the Gulf region.
Well, do you think that the revolutionary Islamic movement threatens Assad's vision in any way of what he hopes to achieve with Syria?
I don't think so at the moment, except in this sense. That this present conflict in the Gulf is arousing very violent feelings in the Arab and Muslim worlds at the popular levels. And of course, Assad, from that point of view, is on the wrong side. He's on the Allied side. And he's in a rather uncomfortable position there. I mean, you may have noticed just in the last few days that, for example, the chief of staff of the Pakistan Army, now, he has come out very strongly against this war and against the Allies. He said this is an imperialist and Zionist war being waged against Muslims. In Morocco, there's been a general strike against the war. And right around the Arab and Muslim world, there have been protests and indeed acts of terrorism addressed at Western interests. And so this, of course, puts Assad in a rather embarrassing position. And every time that Saddam Hussein manages to lob a scud at Israel, popular opinion in Syria puts pressure on Assad to change camps. Now, he's not going to change camp because if he were to defect from the coalition, if he were to take a small step towards Saddam, he would risk being attacked by Israel. Israel might seize what it considered a historic chance to destroy Syria's military potential, just as the Allies were destroying Iraq's, which of course would allow Israel to reign supreme in the region. And Assad is not going to give Israel that opportunity. So in a sense, the Syrian position is rather like a mirror image of Israel's. Israel is being handsomely rewarded for staying out of the war. Assad hopes to be rewarded for staying inside the coalition.
So you think that even if Israel does retaliate against Iraq, that Syria will not withdraw from the coalition?
Amy, it very much depends on the scale of the Israeli response. Let's imagine that in desperation, Saddam Hussein were to launch a Scud armed with a chemical warhead at Israel. Now, if that were to happen, I would anticipate a very powerful Israeli response. They've more or less said so. Now, if that were to happen, say a massive assault with conventional or unconventional weapons against Iraqi population centers, then I think it would be impossible for countries like Syria to stay out. Indeed, I would anticipate that both Syria and Iran might come in on the side of Iraq. Indeed, you may have noticed that quite recently, in the last few days, Syria's vice president and foreign minister paid a visit to Tehran, clearly to coordinate their strategies in the event of a massive Israeli attack on Iraq. Then, of course, we have this rather fascinating development of all these Iraqi planes which have landed in Tehran, at Iranian air bases.
What do you think is going on with those planes?
Well, I think what we can say is that they've gone there by design rather than by defection, that there's obviously been some prior arrangement between Baghdad and Tehran. I learned just today from my Iranian sources a number of interesting things. First, that these Iraqi planes are actually exercising inside Iran. The pilots are flying them in Iran on a regular basis. Secondly, I'm told that the Iranians, I was talking today to Tehran, to an Iranian intelligence source, he told me something very fascinating, and this was that President Saddam's wife and children were in Iran and not in Tanzania, as has been generally reported, and also that the families of several Iraqi ministers had also taken refuge in Iran. Now, this tells us a lot, I think, about Iran's present position. In this conflict, Iran and Iraq, so recently bitter enemies, now have a number of common interests. One of their interests is to prevent a victorious United States lording it over the Gulf region. Neither of them want a permanent Western military presence in their backyard. Another common interest Iraq and Iran have is to contain Turkey. They are both frightened that Turkey might help itself to part of an enfeebled Iraq. It might, for example, try and seize the oil-bearing province of Mosul. And so this conflict has brought Iran and Iraq closer together.
My guest is Patrick Seal, author of Assad, The Struggle for the Middle East. We'll talk more after a short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Patrick Seal, author of Assad, The Struggle for the Middle East. Could you play out a scenario for us about what you think will happen with Syria once the fighting stops?
President Assad is, I think, very concerned about the post-war order. Of course, there's been a lot of speculation about what that order might be. But if you look at it from his point of view, what does he see? He sees a shattered and enfeebled Arab world, with Iraq largely destroyed, and certainly not able to give him the sort of help he might expect in a war against Israel. He sees a victorious United States. He sees an Israel whose strategic environment has been fundamentally improved by the destruction of Iraq. And he sees a Palestinian movement in grave disarray because its leaders have been foolish enough to tie their fortunes to Saddam's wagon. And so in such a post-war situation, the balance of power is overwhelmingly on the side of the United States and Israel. And so this is a subject of much concern for President Assad. So what has he tried to do? He's tried to improve his relations with Saudi Arabia and Egypt, two allies of the United States. He's tried to form a sort of axis with them. And he's tried to impress on the United States, in his meetings with James Baker, in his meeting with President Bush last November, that there can be no stable settlement in the Middle East unless Syria's interests are addressed, that favoring Israel is simply inviting the Arabs to retaliate, and that the Palestine problem must be solved whether or not Yasser Arafat is the right man to represent the Palestinians. This is the sort of message he's been putting across.
Among the masses in the Middle East, do they tend to be Islamic revolutionaries?
I think it's a grave mistake to imagine that the Arab world is made up of Islamic fanatics or Islamic revolutionaries. This is definitely not the case. Arabs are very often pious. There's a great deal of piety in the region. Religion still means a great deal to them in a way that it doesn't really mean very much to many people in the Western world. Now, in addition to that, one should say that in many countries, particularly those countries without proper political institutions or democratic forms of government, Islam has become a vehicle for protest, for social, economic, and political protest. And in many Arab countries, wanting to protest against the incompetence of their leaders and the incompetence of the national regimes under which they've lived for many years, who failed, as they would see it, to solve some of the fundamental problems of the Middle East, notably in the confrontation with Israel, then under such circumstances, you get a growth of Islamic activism. But this is a political movement and should not be thought of in terms of every inhabitant of those countries being a sort of Islamic revolutionary.
Patrick Seal has written several books on the Middle East, including a recent biography of Hafez al-Assad. When you were working on your biography of Assad, you were given unprecedented access to him. How were you able to spend time with him? What kind of access did you have? Did he prescribe certain limits on what you could ask or what he would talk about?
I first met Assad in 1977. He had admired my earlier book, which you were kind enough to mention, The Struggle for Syria, and he had recommended it to some of his cadres, and indeed it had been translated into Arabic. And it was at that stage that he suggested rather playfully that I should write a second volume. But I didn't feel ready to do that, and not enough had happened, as it were. And then when he fell ill in 1984, I thought I'd better hurry up, otherwise I might miss the chance. And so I went back to Syria and contacted him. And I had a whole series of meetings with him then over the years, from 84 or 85 onwards, right up to 88. And I must say, he proved a very easy man to interview, except that most of the our meetings were held very late at night, and I was sort of dying with fatigue. But he showed extraordinary resilience. He put no restrictions on what I could ask him. In fact, he repeatedly said to me that he didn't want to influence me one bit. Of course, when the book finally appeared, I was very sorry to see that he banned it in Syria. It's not allowed on sale in Syria. And one has to conclude that though the book was generally favorable to him, I would say, and that I tried to explain his policies, it wasn't perhaps the 100% endorsement which he might have liked.
He's known for supporting terrorists and taking very vengeful action against his enemies. When you sat down to write the book, did this cross your mind at all? Did you fear that something might happen to you if you wrote the wrong thing?
Not at all. And I think his reputation as a terrorist has been largely overplayed, I would say, by his enemies, who have an interest in labeling him as such. I mean, the Middle East is a tough place. I don't think that any state in the region can claim to occupy the moral high ground. Every state in the region, Iraq, Israel, Syria, Jordan, have all got tough security services. They're all very similar, as a matter of fact, in the way they treat their prisoners, in the hit teams they send out, and so forth.
What kind of man is Assad? Could you describe him for us?
Well, Assad is a very cerebral figure. He's a self-taught intellectual. He's as different as you can imagine from the rash, vainglorious Saddam Hussein. His passion is grand strategy, and he plots his moves with very quiet and rather ponderous deliberation. He's a cautious man. He's a loner. His favorite instrument of government is the telephone. He seems to shun human contact.
Patrick Seal, thanks so much for speaking with us today.
Thank you, Amy.
Patrick Seal spoke with Fresh Air producer Amy Sallet. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.